The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
There are really two separate but interrelated trends in the development of papal power, which is one of the crucial things coming out of this period that we're studying from 100 to 600. One of these two is the claim to supremacy of Rome within the church itself. And the other is the growth of papal political power in medieval Europe. In other words, not just within the church, but within the whole complex of nations. The former claim, that is of supremacy within the church, was asserted rather early. We saw hints of it even in some of the second century fathers. Clement of Rome, late first century, our earliest sub-apostolic writing. You got some indication, even though he was not clearly a monarchical bishop, the only one ruling the church in Rome, whether he's functioning as sort of a secretary for the collegial group of presbyters in Rome, he is writing to the church in Corinth as though the church in Rome has some authority with regard to the church in Corinth. Irenaeus, it may be that in his opposition to the heresies like the Gnostics, Rome simply provides him the best example of a continuity back to the time of the apostles. Nevertheless, it is the church at Rome that he uses to establish the fact that we in Lyon know what the truth is because we can have bishops right back to the time of the apostles in the church at Rome. But this claim to supremacy within the church was not universally recognized. For example, Cyprian in Carthage in North Africa in the 3rd century had his battle with Pope Stephen. Well, shouldn't use the word Pope that early. Bishop Stephen of Rome. And emphasize the authority of all the bishops. Cyprian really didn't want to accept the fact that the Bishop of Rome was supreme. And Augustine, in the late 4th century and into the 5th century, he has respect for the church at Rome. He revered Rome, but didn't necessarily agree with everything Rome was going to say. He would test it according to Scripture. And also this claim to supremacy was disputed by the Greek church. Now, there you had these major patriarchates of Alexandria and Antioch. Jerusalem would have a lot of traditional claims, even though not as large a church. And eventually Constantinople, where the emperor is. And the Eastern church had, again, a respect for Rome as having a primacy, but being first among equals and not supremacy. And the Council of Chalcedon in 451 practically placed Constantinople on a par with Rome in determining that now where the emperor is seated, the church, that patriarchate has a certain kind of authority equal with Rome. Even though the Eastern Orthodox Church basically regarded Rome as first among the equals. Now, the basis for this primacy was the supposed dual founding of the church at Rome by Paul and Peter. So, two apostles. No other church could really claim that. Now, if you look at the New Testament evidence, you can see that the church at Rome existed before Paul ever got there. The Epistle to the Romans makes that very clear. So you can't really say that either Paul or Peter founded the church at Rome, but they are connected with the church. And it's very likely that both of them did die there in the Neronic persecution. And then there is the Petrine theory that developed, that Peter was the first among the apostles, and hence those who succeed him carry on that role of supremacy within the church. And this is the doctrine of apostolic succession. So you can see these various things getting combined to give the church at Rome its prominence. I think we could say that actually the supremacy of Rome stems from the prominence of the city itself. It was, of course, the original capital of the Roman Empire. It was the city-state that extended out across the whole Mediterranean world and established its political authority. Obviously, in the time of the New Testament, the Romans are governing in Judea, and they may have some puppet-type rulers that they select and influence, but they're the dominant force, and the city of Rome is what's behind all that. Michael. Well, I think the claim, I don't know the actual answer, how the Catholics answer that particular one, but I think the claim is that James had become the bishop in Jerusalem, and Peter, like Paul later, actually was branching out, doing missionary work he did get to Antioch eventually, where Paul had to rebuke him. I'm thinking more of the seaport, Caesarea, I guess, yeah. And so he was already branching out in a way that James apparently didn't. James, the traditions are that James became the leader of the church in Jerusalem and so on. So that would probably be their way of handling that, yes. Well, let me get to the development of the primacy of Peter among the apostles and the scriptural basis for that, because that you do get popes and anti-popes later on. You're quite right. By the way, a book that is probably, it's in paperback now. I meant to bring my copy and couldn't locate it. Did anybody here borrow my copy of J.N.D. Kelly on the History of the Papacy? Because it's just in one volume, gives little blurbs on each of the popes in the whole list. And it is true, at various times you'll get that kind of rivalry for the papacy. But you don't get that sense of it here at the beginning. The more liberal critics of the scripture have tried to emphasize the differences between James, Peter, Paul, and so forth in the early church. And most evangelical scholars feel that's been overplayed. And really there was a great harmony among them. Certainly different emphases in certain contexts, but not any contradiction. But I think back here, it's the Catholic answer on that one is probably because of Peter's missionary work already, that he was moving out from Jerusalem, and James was left there to be the main leader. But I think it's the prominence of the city of Rome itself that accounts for this role in the church, plus the fact that there was no rival to Rome in the West. You did have these significant patriarchates like Alexandria and Antioch in the East. But in the West, the only thing that came anywhere near rivaling was Carthage, which was a much smaller city, and North Africa much less populated than Italy was, and so forth. And so there wouldn't be that claim. And there was no other city in the West that had been affected by the apostles, as far as any records show. Certainly nobody claiming apostolic foundation. The other thing that contributes to the prominence of Rome within the church is the fact that the church at Rome continually adheres to the position that proved orthodox. The Marcion heresy, Gnosticism, Sabellianism, Apollinarianism, Arianism, you name it, all the way down the line, Rome opposes each of those heresies. And the only exception in this well, it's beyond 600 actually, is the monothelitism, where Pope Honorius did make some statements before the council had ruled on that subject that makes it sound as though he held to monothelitism. It's a good thing to know about, so you can bring that up if you're ever discussing such things with the Catholics. But by and large, the Church at Rome stayed sound in all these early heresies. Honorius. We mentioned that briefly in the lecture on the ecumenical councils. And I think his dates and so forth are on that outline. Now, what else happened here is that the assertion of these claims on the part of the Church at Rome had some success whenever the incumbent bishop of Rome was a particularly capable leader, as one would expect. That would be the case. For example, Innocent I, who's bishop of Rome from 401 to 417, this is during Augustine's lifetime, was a very capable man. And the respect for the Church at Rome's claims increased when you had a very capable and upright man in such a position. Innocent I used the decisions of the Council of Sirdica in 343, so an earlier church council, that a deposed bishop could appeal his case to Rome, and no successor should be recognized without Rome's approval. That's what that council had ruled. And Innocent used this to make the claim of universal jurisdiction within the church on the part of the Bishop of Rome. The next great step is with Pope Leo I, 440 to 461, because he develops the Petrine theory. That is, that Peter had primacy among the apostles in faith and in government, and then he connected it with the doctrine of apostolic succession, so that there is this connection right on down. Now, one thing that we ought to acknowledge is that Peter does play a leading role in the early apostolic time. And the key passages, Matthew chapter 16, verses 16 to 19, where Peter makes his great confession there at Caesarea Philippi. Jesus is asking them, who do men say that the Son of Man is? And they have different answers. Some say John the Baptist. Others say Elijah. Still others, Jeremiah or one of the prophets. But what about you, he asks. Who do you say I am? And Simon Peter answered, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus replied, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by man, but by my Father in heaven. And I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. So this is a very strong statement. Of course, there's the play of words on Peter's name, which means rock. And the debate that still goes on in some circles is, what is the rock on which Jesus is founding the church? Is it Peter himself, or is it his confession? Even Professor John Murray was willing to say, in this context, it's Peter, which includes his confession. And you look ahead, and Peter does play the leading role in the early church. First eight chapters of Acts and so on. Now, the interesting thing, though, is that right in a context like that of the Caesarea Philippi confession, I read you through verse 19, and then it goes on to say, in just the next verses, then he warned his disciples not to tell anyone that he was the Christ. From that time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things the hands of the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. "Never, Lord," he said. "This shall never happen to you." Jesus turned and said to Peter, "Out of my sight, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me. You do not have in mind the things of God, but the things of men." So right in the same context of this great confession, you see Peter's fleshly inability to understand what the Lord was doing and his impetuous rebuke of the Lord himself. Over in Luke 22, you have another interesting passage where Peter is singled out as having a significant role. This is the passage of the Last Supper in Luke's Gospel, beginning at verse 31. Jesus has just said, "You are those who have stood by me in my trials. I confer on you a kingdom, just as my Father conferred one on me, so that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom and sit on thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel." By the way, the promise of the keys that is given to Peter in Matthew 16 is later given to all of the 12. So it's something not excluded exclusively to him. But in this context, Luke 22:31, Jesus goes on, "Simon, Simon, Satan has asked to sift you as wheat." And the "you" there is plural, all of the disciples. "But I have prayed for you, Simon," this is singular, "that your faith may not fail. And when you have turned back, strengthen your brothers." So here you have the Lord recognizing a special role that Peter's going to have, a real leadership role. And yet you go right on with that in verse 33. "But Peter replied, Lord, I am ready to go with you to prison and to death. Jesus answered, I tell you, Peter," it's interesting that he calls him Simon first, and then the rock, Peter, when he's saying, "I tell you, Peter, before the rooster crows today, you will deny three times that you know me." So here again, right at the time when Peter singled out for leadership, his denial is also included in the very same context. Peter himself, I think, gives a marvelous statement in 1 Peter chapter 5, in verses 1 through 7. "To the elders among you, I appeal as a fellow elder, sum presbyteros." It's very interesting that Peter should use that term for himself. He's clearly writing as an apostle, and we know the kinds of claims that Paul made for the apostolic office. But he puts himself down as on a par with the other elders. "To the elders among you, I appeal as a fellow elder, a witness of Christ's sufferings, and one who also will share in the glory to be revealed. Be shepherds of God's flock that is under your care, serving as overseers, not because you must, but because you are willing, as God wants you to be, not greedy for money, but eager to serve, not lording it over those entrusted to you, but being examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the crown of glory that will never fade away. Young men, in the same way, be submissive to those who are older. Clothe yourselves with humility toward one another, because," then he quotes from Proverbs 3:34 that I used from James in the chapel time, "God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Humble yourselves, therefore, under God's mighty hand, that he may lift you up in due time. Cast all your anxiety on him, because he cares for you." So there's Peter's own attitude, a very humble one. And the claims to spiritual headship would be established by the leadership developed in the political vacuum of Western Europe. And that's why I want to turn now to the development of papal political power as what really contributes to the medieval papacy at the height of its influence later on, around 1200. The early Middle Ages then. Leo I symbolizes the political leadership falling to the Pope in the West, when he negotiated with Attila the Hun to spare Rome in 452. The Huns were an Asian tribal group. The Germanic tribes, like the Visigoths and the Vandals, were scary enough to the Roman Empire. But even the so-called barbarian Germanic groups were scared of the Huns. They were really violent and vicious and so forth. One of the stories told by one of the Gothic writers, one of the Germanic peoples, is these Huns tenderized their meat by riding with it under their saddle, and also would drink from the skulls of their conquered enemies and so forth. Pretty scary people. But Attila the Hun was one who already was putting the pressure on these Germanic groups to move into the Roman world. And he comes down into the Roman world himself in 452 and is ready to besiege the city of Rome. And there's no effective governor to deal with him. And so it's Leo, the bishop of Rome, who goes out to negotiate. And he does so successfully. Not that Attila is overcome, but he's at least negotiates a peaceful transition. The Western emperors were no longer strong enough to cope. So Leo argued that the emperor's real role is protector of the church as sort of an assistant to the pope's work. Now what happens here is a kind of leapfrog. Whenever the Bishop of Rome makes certain claims, we find the emperor over in Constantinople capitalizing on it and trying to turn the tables. So the Byzantine emperor takes this claim very seriously, that the emperor's role is to be protector of the church and kind of assistant to the pope in his work, and now viewed himself as a Christ-like king priest who might decree the faith without a council. We saw how Caesaropapism developed from the time of Constantine on in the Byzantine or Eastern Roman Empire, and we'll get certain of the emperors who particularly developed this idea in this fashion. Well, Pope Gelasius I, he has a very brief time as Bishop of Rome, 492 to 496, but again, he's one of these very able bishops of Rome, trained in law and so on. He says that the emperor must learn what is Christian from the ordained pope, who has auctoritas. Our word authority comes from this Latin term. And the emperor has merely potestas, power, to carry out what auctoritas lays down. So you get, these were well-defined Roman legal terms that everybody understood at that time, that auctoritas is really a higher authority than mere potestas, the executive power to carry things out. Gelasius went on to say that the priestly authority would be held responsible on the judgment day for the actions not only of himself, but of the emperor as well. And so any time you claim greater responsibility, you're really implying a greater power, greater authority. Well, the Emperor Justinian in the 6th century turned the Gelasian theory upside down. He said, in effect, and Justinian was, remember, the one who reconquered the Western Roman Empire, doing great battle with the different Germanic groups that had taken over Italy and most of the West. He also was the one who built the Sancta Sophia, great church which still stands in Constantinople, taken over by the Muslims for quite a while, and then codified the Roman law. And so we have the Justinian Code from these times. So he's one of the great emperors of the ancient world, but he was no mean theologian as well. He said, in effect, in response to Gelasius's views, that since the priesthood is so important, the emperor must be concerned about its honesty and suitability. In other words, I better select the people who are going to serve in such a role. So you can see this kind of leapfrog going. One makes a claim, and then the other one tries to make a further claim based on what the previous one has said. Christian society, and thus of the Pope's jurisdiction, as extending beyond the territories controlled by the emperor. And one example would be England. England, Angleland, named after the Anglo-Saxons who had conquered it from Rome. Rome had control, at least the southern part of England, Britain, for some while. But eventually the Roman troops had to be drawn back as the Germanic peoples took over. And among those were the Angles and the Saxons from over in northern Germany, Saxony, and what's now Denmark and so forth. And Gregory had a vision for bringing the Christian faith to these Germanic peoples. They're outside the pale of the Roman Empire. But his missionary vision then starts to develop the idea of the Pope's jurisdiction as being wider than any political entity. It was hard for people to conceive of anything greater than the Roman Empire, but now the church is going to go beyond that boundary. By this time, the papacy did have power based on land, the so-called patrimony of St. Peter, which included much of southern Italy. Gregory himself was from the noble class, and he inherited much land which he bestowed on the church. And so a lot of this became not just southern Italy, but some other areas as well, the Pope's own political territory. It's really the basis for what we still have today in the Vatican, the Papal States, which is now reduced just to, what is it, 2 square miles? It's very relatively small now, but it's still a political entity of its own. And for a long time, actually up until the consolidation, the unification of Italy in the 19th century, the Papal States were a significant band right across the central part of Italy. And the Pope governed that territory. And this got quite extensive back in the medieval period. The Pope, by the Renaissance, where you get the Renaissance politics, is often a lot of the rival city-states of Italy, Venice, Milan, Florence, Genoa, Pisa, and so on. And Rome is just right in there among the rest with the Pope as the ruler of the city-state of Rome. And some of the Renaissance popes were great warriors, particularly Pope Julius, who is satirized by Erasmus for his warfare and so on. But at any rate, this the basis for it is in Gregory's time, the Pope becoming a landlord, in effect. Now, this land would be added to in the 8th century through the donation of Pepin. And this gets us into some fascinating political developments of the 8th century. Again, we're going beyond our time frame. I realize that. But for you to see how this development unfolds and takes place, Pepin was the Frankish ruler. The Franks were the rising power within what's now France, Frankland. And Pepin came and conquered the Lombards of northern Italy in 756. The Lombards, their name Longobard, simply means they had long beards. They were the last of these Germanic peoples to invade into the old Roman territory, and they had basically settled in northern Italy by the mid-8th century, and they were putting various kinds of pressure on the Bishop of Rome and his territory. So the Pope needed some help from somewhere. So he makes this alliance with the Frankish family that is not yet recognized as the ruling family in Frankland. Pepin is going to be the ancestor of Charlemagne eventually, which and their family will become the recognized rulers of the Franks. But the descendants of Clovis, the so-called Merovingian dynasty, were still ruling, but they'd become so feeble that the last heir of the Merovingian dynasty had to be sort of rolled out in a wheelbarrow for ceremonial occasions. And so it's clear that the military leaders were the real power behind the throne, and Pepin was that. So the Pepin comes down, defeats the Lombards, and makes then a donation of the territory the Lombards held to the Bishop of Rome, to the Pope. Now, where does he get such an idea? This position of the Pope is reflected in a document called the Donation of Constantine. And that document claimed that the first Christian emperor, Constantine, had turned over power in the West to the Pope. Now, the idea was that Constantine got leprosy, and Pope Sylvester, and he was the actual Bishop of Rome in Constantine's time, healed him of the leprosy. And Constantine was so grateful that he took his crown and gave it to the Pope. And the Pope Sylvester says, "No, no, no, that's not right," and puts it back on the head of Constantine. All right, there's a symbolic act there. That the crown really belongs to the emperor because the Pope has given it to him. That's significant. But then Constantine says, "Okay, I'm going to go build a new city, Constantinople, on the old fortress of Byzantium, and make it the capital of the empire, but you will rule in Rome. I'm going to leave the old capital to you." All of this is in this document called the Donation of Constantine. Now, we don't know how far back it goes. It clearly was believed by Pepin to be an authentic thing. And from your knowledge of history now, you can see how plausible this was, because Constantine indeed was the first Christian emperor. He did move the capital to what's now Constantinople, what was then Constantinople, and so forth. So there is a certain historic plausibility to it. This document was proven to be fraudulent, to be a forgery, in the 15th century, right on the eve of the Reformation. One of the Renaissance scholars, Lorenzo Valla, used higher criticism, basically to prove that this document could not have come from the period it claimed to be from. He pointed out certain things that were not chronologically accurate and so forth. At any rate, what it represents is an alliance between the Pope and the Frankish ruler that eventually resulted in the coronation of Charlemagne on Christmas Day in 800 by the Pope as not merely king of the Franks and of the Lombards, but Imperator Romanorum, Roman Emperor. Now, that would be very controversial because there's somebody over in Constantinople who claims to be the Roman emperor. And Charlemagne later said if he had known this was going to happen, he never would have gone to church on that day, at Christmas Day. You snicker, and most historians do too, because they feel that although Charlemagne was a pretty honorable character, he must have known this was going to happen. In medieval church history, you'll learn there were various motivations going on among different people surrounding that. But the whole idea of the papacy being this involved in politics had dire implications for both church and state. The Germanic Empire that stems from Charlemagne, what gets called the Holy Roman Empire, remember Voltaire in the 18th century made the clever remark that it was neither holy nor Roman nor an empire. And that's pretty true through much of its history. but it continually interferes in the life of the church. Later on, we'll see in the third point some of the times when this occurred, of the Germanic emperor coming and setting up a pope, setting down another one, and so forth. And on the other hand, it results in the pope making claims to political supremacy, not just a primacy within the life of the church, but actually the ability to put down rulers and set up other rulers and so forth in the political realm. So that's the sad implication of all that. I think we've got time to go ahead with point number three, unless there's some questions you wanted to raise at this point. Okay, I want to show now the results of this in the High Middle Ages. Go ahead. Yeah, his basic idea was if the priesthood is so important, as Gelasius was claiming, that it has auctoritas and really should determine what program the emperor should follow, then the emperor better have some role in selecting the priesthood. And that's what we later call lay investiture. Justinian didn't use that term, but that's what it becomes known as in the Western European world. The investing of church office by a layman, not a priest, an ordained priest. Yes?
Can you explain where the term patrimony of St. Peter comes
from? Yeah, patrimony simply means the inherited legacy that one passes on from generation to generation. And the idea was that this land now belonged to the papacy to pass on to the heirs to the papacy. It would hold this territory as well.
So you're linking that to the apostolic succession?
Yeah, yeah. The main new thing here is that now there's this important territory, which is the production of wealth. It means the pope has all the agricultural products, the cattle on the Thousand Hills or whatever that this property produces. So, and it's not only economically but politically significant. Any other question at this point? Well, let's plunge on into the higher Middle Ages then, just to see where this takes us. The 11th century, which means the 1000s, produces the clash known as the investiture controversy. After a decline of the papacy and domination by the German emperor in the 10th and early 11th century, a reform movement develops, which takes its name from Pope Gregory VII. His dates as Bishop of Rome are 1073 to 1085. Formerly, he was the monk Hildebrand, who had been really the power behind the papal throne for a generation. And now that Hildebrand is Pope Gregory VII, he implements several reforms that are known as the Gregorian Reform Movement. Yes?
Did you say he was the power behind the throne?
The papal throne. Yeah, that terminology is now used because there is such political power. Although even a bishop's chair, the word see, by the way, S-E-E, comes from sedes in Latin for seat, the bishop's throne. You still talk about a bishop having a throne, a chair from which he rules. So there are four parts to the Gregorian reform of the former monk Hildebrand once he's Pope Gregory VII. One is an end to simony, and we should all cheer. Simony was taken from the name Simon Magus in the book of Acts. You remember he was the one that when he saw Peter bestow the Holy Spirit on people, he offered money to be able to have that kind of power, and Peter in effect tells him, go to hell. That's really about what that means. May you perish with your money. You're not right with God. And the name then gets attached to this idea of purchasing church office, simony, from Simon Magus. And this had gone on. This had gone on quite a bit now that church office meant certain powers, landholdings, often a castle, so forth, so that people had bought such office. So Gregory's right to want to bring simony to an end. A second thing was an end to lay investiture. That is, the kind of thing that Justinian wanted to do for the political ruler, the secular ruler, to bestow church office, to decide who's going to be bishop or who's going to be abbot of this monastery. Any powerful position that carries with it land, which meant really provision of troops in the feudal system, as well as agricultural products and horses, so forth, the things that are valuable to a secular ruler. And you can see the plausibility of it, a secular ruler feeling, I've got to have, as Archbishop of Mainz, somebody I can rely on. So I'm going to choose my cousin to do that. And that had gone on by this time quite a bit. So Gregory was right to want to end that practice. The third point in his reform was celibacy of the clergy. Now, it had become customary for not only monks to be celibate, but for priests to be celibate and not be married. However, it was very common, there's plenty of evidence for it, in this period that many, many priests had common law wives or concubines. And yet they claimed, they professed to be operating in a celibate fashion. And you knew that any of the people in the parish were aware of what was going on. So it undermined the moral authority of the priest. Now, Gregory, in other words, had diagnosed a real problem, but he came up with the wrong remedy for it. Instead of, as Protestantism would later do in the Reformation, saying the clergy can be married, and as the Greek church had done, he said all priests now must be celibate and sought to enforce that. And the fourth point of his reform was the supremacy of the Pope. Probably Gregory realized the only way he's going to enforce these various points of his reform movement is to insist on the supremacy of the Pope, even to the point of deposing a king, if necessary, or the Holy Roman Emperor. And that's really what he sought to do eventually. But we have the document, the Dictatus Papae, the dictates of the Pope. By the way, the word Pope just comes from the word Papa, meaning father. But the dictates of the Pope from Gregory's seventh time includes all kinds. There are scores of different provisions that go into the supremacy of the Pope, including that people, as they approach the Pope, are to kiss his big toe. Those things are actually in the Dictatus Papae. So, yes?
When you say supremacy of the Pope, is this with respect to the political power?
Right.
Not the other
right. Powers? Even the political realm. That's the thing that's really new and significant here. Now, although Gregory himself died in exile in his battle with King Henry IV of Germany, who was the Holy Roman Emperor at the time, nevertheless, while he in a way lost the struggle he had with Henry IV by dying in exile, he left a lasting impression on the minds of people in European Christendom by the submission of the Emperor Henry IV to him at Canossa in northern Italy in 1077. What happened was that in the whole process of negotiations between the Pope and the Emperor in trying to find out who would select the church officers and so forth, and I won't try to give you all the detail, at a certain point, Gregory VII is moving north from Rome up into Germany in order to hold a council at which Henry IV will be deposed, as well as excommunicated. He's already pronounced his excommunication. He's going to depose him as emperor and install somebody else. Henry is desperate enough, he's a young ruler at this point, and he and some of his followers come through the Alps into northern Italy in the winter, and he goes as a penitent, barefoot, to be absolved by the Pope. Pope keeps him waiting out there for a couple of days, trying to decide what to do. But ultimately, what can a spiritual leader do when he has a king coming penitent, barefoot on his knees in the snow? And so he does absolve him. And hence, Henry gets back his throne and is able then to carry on the struggle, and Gregory dies in exile. But the impression left on the minds of people in Europe is of the emperor bowing before the Pope and the Pope absolving him of his sin. Well, we'll pick it up next time at that point and see where else this leads. Now, in the development of the papacy, we had gotten down to into the third point on the outline. We made the point that there were two different trends developing from the early period that we've been studying. One is papal supremacy within the church itself, but then the other dimension is papal political power in the secular realm. And we saw how that developed in various ways, particularly in the time of Pope Leo I, who is the same one who submitted his tome to the Council of Chalcedon, where it prevailed in the views on the two natures and one person of Christ. But he's also the one that went out and negotiated with Attila the Hun when the Huns were invading Italy and kept Rome from being completely sacked at that time. And then we saw how there was this later development, kind of triangular alliance between the papacy and the Frankish ruling house, growing out of the Donation of Constantine, that document that was, by the Renaissance period, proved a forgery, fraudulent, many anachronisms in it. And then we came to the High Middle Ages just to show where these trends were leading. And I described the investiture controversy of the 11th century with the conflict between Pope Gregory VII and the king in Germany who had the title of Holy Roman Emperor, Henry IV, a young king who came to the throne still in his 20s. Always an occasion then for the nobility to test his strength by rising up in rebellion. And so the papacy makes alliance with some of the nobility there. And meanwhile, the king is trying to appoint his own bishops, church figures, and so on by means of lay investiture in order to counteract the Pope's power. In medieval church history, you learn more of the details of that whole conflict. But for our purposes in describing the development of the papacy, we want to see how Hildebrand, who had become the monk Hildebrand, became Pope Gregory VII, had a fourfold program that made up what's called the Gregorian Reform. Number one, an end to simony, that is the purchase of church office, taken from Simon Magus in Acts chapter 8. Number two, an end to lay investiture, that is a non-churchman like a king or a lord in the secular realm, appointing the key bishops in the realm and so forth, bestowing church office. Number three, celibacy of the clergy, which you remember in the Eastern Orthodox Church still is not a requirement except for the monks and then those who would become bishops. But the regular parish priest can be married. But Gregory now is going to insist that in the church under his jurisdiction, all parish priests must be celibate. It's not that that was entirely new, but he's now going to enforce it. And common law wives among priests were one of the scandals across much of Europe by that time, and he did what he could to clean that up. So the first three points of the Gregorian Reform are ones we could all feel positive about. At least he's dealing with genuine problems. The celibacy of the clergy, of course, is the wrong non-biblical solution. But the fourth is the key one for our purposes, and that is the supremacy of the Pope. And in Gregory's case, this really meant not only over the hierarchy within the church, but even to the point of being able to depose kings like Henry IV, which he actually sought to do. We left off last time with the point that in the conflict between Gregory VII and Henry IV, Gregory ultimately lost. He ended up in exile from Rome, but in the process of that conflict at 1077 in Canossa, when the Pope was traveling north towards the Alps, to cross the Alps and go into Germany and have a council there which would depose Henry from being King and Holy Roman Emperor, Henry beat him to the punch, in effect, coming through the Alps in the wintertime and approaching where the Pope was staying in a castle at Canossa as a penitent, barefoot in the snow, waiting 3 days for the Pope to decide what to do. The Pope realized he couldn't fail to absolve a penitent sinner. And so the lasting scene, Henry solves his problem that way. He avoids being deposed, regains his powers, and hence ends up forcing the Pope into exile later on. But the lasting impression on the minds of European Christians was the king, the emperor, kneeling in the snow barefoot, and the Pope standing over him, absolving him of his sin. And so the impression of the ultimate authority being with the church figure, the Pope. That's where we left off last time. And the consequences of that battle, while not immediate in their effect, included the Crusades. It's not long after Gregory VII, you see his death is in 1085, that Urban II, just a decade later, in 1095, preaches, as a successor in the Gregorian Reform movement, preaches the First Crusade to get these Frankish warriors to go off to the Middle East and rid the Holy Land of the infidel, the Muslim Turks, at the request of the Byzantine Emperor. Brian? Gregorian chant goes back at least to the 9th century with the monastery of Cluny. Well, that would be 10th century, really. Here we are in late 11th century, and it's named after Gregory I, known as Gregory the Great, who was Pope around 600, in the 590s into the early 600s. So there isn't good evidence that Gregory the Great actually did produce what's called Gregorian chant. We only have evidence for it somewhat later, but he may have started that. He made many contributions to the Roman liturgical practices and so on. The Roman Catholic Church is good at making accommodations in order to be inclusive and get as many people under the umbrella of the sacramental system as possible. The another example is when the followers of John Huss, Bohemia, he was burned at the stake at the Council of Constance in 1415. But then his followers split into two groups. One of their insistences was that they receive Mass in two kinds, both kinds, the bread and the wine, whereas the practice still in the Roman Catholic Church is only the priest takes the wine. Well, they accommodated a certain number of the Bohemian followers of Huss to give them communion in two kinds. So they're good at doing that. You'll sometimes find married clergy in the Roman Church now, and you'll discover that it's a former Anglican or Episcopal priest who was married, but then came into the Catholic Church. And So they will make exceptions to the rules when they feel they have a good reason to. I brought the Catholic Catechism with me today, and let's just see if it gives anything about the Eastern Rite in here. It may not be something that the Catechism covers. No listing under the Eastern Rite. Let's try Byzantine Rite. No. Since it's an exception to the rule, they don't put it in there. But the Crusades then came as a result of the Gregorian Reform movement, which shows the church moving into this political realm, not only deposing a king, but now getting military forces to go. And not that the Pope was himself leading the army, but he's the cause of getting the army going. Pope Urban II made one of the most successful speeches ever in Clermont in southern France, outdoors, up on a hill with people who would relay his message to the hills beyond. Quite an emotional address describing the horrors of what was being done in the Holy Land that got these Frankish warriors ready to go. But also in that same era is the effective use of the disciplinary powers of the papacy, excommunication, obviously, and Gregory does excommunicate Henry at one point in a rather fiery letter. So to deprive an individual of the sacraments, who's outside of the good will of the church. Then there is the interdict. The interdict is kind of a corporate excommunication. It doesn't deprive a country of all the sacraments. For instance, baptism, they never want to withhold baptism altogether, but it can only take place at home, not in the church. Marriage is viewed by the Catholics as a sacrament, and then when a country's under the interdict, no marriages can be contracted and carried out by a priest. You can imagine the pressure that would put on a ruler to have his people deprived of being able to get married. No priests allowed at burial services. You could have confession, but no Eucharist or extreme unction. So the most meaningful kinds of sacraments, remember these are people now who believe that salvation is by way of the sacraments. The sacramental system is the way of salvation. So a pope like Innocent III, who's the most powerful of all in the early 1200s, dealing with King John of England, the king of the time of Robin Hood and so forth, and whose brother Richard the Lionheart went on the Third Crusade, when John doesn't do what the Pope wants done in England, he slaps England with an interdict. And that puts tremendous pressure on a ruler to come into conformity to the Pope's will with all these pressures on his people. And then third, after excommunication and the interdict, is the Inquisition. The Inquisition has a very bad name for most of us because of the Spanish Inquisition following the Reformation era. But it basically is a neutral word that just means an inquiry, an investigation. But it had certain provisions to it that made it a very threatening kind of process. First of all, the one conducting an Inquisition would be a friar. Usually a Dominican, a pun on the name Dominican, Dominicani, the hounds of the Lord. They usually conducted the Inquisitions in this period of the High Middle Ages. And the point of it being a friar rather than the local bishop is the friar is subject only to the Pope. The bishop may be much more influenced by the local people. After all, he's got to live there. Friar can move on. And so the bishop is acquainted. These are his neighbors that are being investigated. But in a trial in Inquisition too, it operated according to what was characteristic Roman law as contrasted with English common law. is that the burden of proof was on the accused. In other words, you're guilty until proven innocent, rather than innocent until proven guilty. And so your neighbor has something against you and whispers to the friar, you're a heretic. He's entertaining heretical views. Well, you've got to prove that isn't true. And you can see how dangerous that would be and how threatening an inquisition in an area that is suspected of heresy could be. Well, Innocent III, Pope from 1198 to 1216, is really the pinnacle. He represents the pinnacle of papal power. He's a very competent man, and not in any way an immoral man. He was trained in law. He came to the papacy still at the height of his powers and vigor. I think he was in his 40s at that time. And the big thing he contributed to the theory of the papacy is that he held to the view that the Pope, the Bishop of Rome, is the vicar of Christ on earth. Now, that expression of vicar or substitute for Christ had been used before, but more typically, even through Gregory VII, the idea was he was the vicar of Peter. You read some of Gregory VII's letters to Henry IV, for example, and it's often as though Peter is speaking through him. And of course, the idea of the primacy of Peter among the apostles and then the idea of apostolic succession gave the Bishop of Rome a certain leadership power. But now Innocent's going beyond that and says, I am vicar of Christ. And we know that when Christ gave the Great Commission, he said, all power, all authority is given unto me in heaven and on earth. But Innocent said, he's in heaven now. And so on earth, the Roman bishop, the Pope, is the vicar of Christ on earth. So whatever authority Christ has in heaven, he is delegated to the Pope on earth.